familiar unwelcome series of notes, two musical tones, a pause, and two more. Jaina froze. Oh no! Didn't you say he checked up on you only an hour ago?
Yes.
She looked stricken.
That should have given me 3 or 4 hours more, at least. I haven't heard of any of the observers doing their checks an hour apart.
She pulled out her comlink and glared at it.
How fast can you get to the temple and sneak back in?
Nowhere near fast enough. He's going to beep again.
The comlink did beep again, the same notes. Jaina winced.
And then he's going to assume I'm too deeply asleep to hear him. He'll go down to my quarters, which only takes a minute, and start ringing the chimes.
If he doesn't get an answer then?
He'll calm the master on duty and they'll force the door. But I have one chance.
She scrabbled around in her pouch and brought out a second comlink. I rewired the door intercom with a comlink matched to this one. I can talk to him as if I'm just inside my quarters. Maybe I can bluff him. Maybe I can convince him he doesn't actually have to see me.
She knew she didn't sound hopeful. She wasn't. What happens if you can't?
She sighed.
I get found out having sneaked out of the temple without my observer. Master Hamner will be obliged to punish me somehow, teaching basic telekinesis to the younglings out in the transitory mist, for example. That's assuming the government doesn't prosecute me, which they might.
Which they will. They're not showing any mercy to the Jedi right now.
She glared at him.
Thanks. You're making me feel much better.
The second comlink sounded, this one with a chime identical to the one at Jaina's temple quarters. She took a deep breath, then pressed the button. She made her voice sound sleepy.
What is it?
Hello, Jedi Solo, it's Dab. Routine location check.
Weren't you... What time is it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it was just an hour ago. My randomizer went off again.
Dab, just go away. I'm tired. I'm in bed. You know I'm here.
I have to see you in person, Jedi Solo. You know the rules.
Jaina switched off the comlink and mouthed a curse. She glanced at Jag.
I'm sunk.
Maybe not. Maybe the Empire can rescue a Jedi.
He reached over and plucked the comlink from her fingers and smiled at her startled expression. He thumbed the comlink on.
Who's out there?
He made his own voice hoarse, sleepy. Jaina stared at him.
It's Dab, Dab Hantak,
Dab said.
Where's my blaster?
Jaina caught on and suppressed a laugh. As she'd heard her mother say many times over the years, she said,
It's under your pillow, where it always is.
Give me just a second. All right, let him in. I'm gonna burn a hole right between his eyes.
Jag, he's only doing his duty.
Vape his duty. Come to think of it, vape the neat little hole between his eyes. I'm gonna burn his face clean off. Closed casket funeral for him. Diplomatic immunity for me. Let him in.
Dab's voice emerged from the comlink.
Jedi Solo, I'm satisfied that you're here. I'm just gonna mark this one as confirmed.
Jaina breathed a silent sigh of relief.
Thank you, Dab. Good night.
Good night.
She took the comlink back and switched it off.
Staying ahead of the moths is keeping you sharp.
Wearing workmen's jumpsuits similar to Seth's, Jag and Winter clambered down through the street-level access hole into the underground just in front of Valen's prison. Jag pulled the hatch closed above them. This was a well-maintained maze of permacrete tunnels, metal pipes, access hatches, and machinery, some of it ancient. None of the tunnels headed in the direction of the prison.
Which is as it should be,
Winter said.
Tunnels to and from the prison would mean a higher rate of escapes.
Jag looked up and down the passageways leading from the access.
So what has Seth been doing? We haven't seen any sign that he's been removing debris.
Let's find out.
Half an hour's exploration revealed some of what Seth had been up to. An electronics junction box that was suspiciously free of grime held an oversized, very powerful data pad recently patched into the box's electronic components. Winter activated it, spent a few minutes bypassing its simple security, and then flipped through the presets in its programming. Each showed a length of permacrete tunnel, walls at right angles to an almost blemish-free floor, dim glow rods in a line across the ceiling. One preset displayed a simple diagram of the underground area, showing the leading edge of the prison
and to spot a quarter kilometer away joined by some sort of access tunnel.
Got it, Winter said. It's a riot raid tunnel.
Which is what exactly?
It's a tunnel with only two accesses. One is at the prison, and it can't be opened from the prison side. It's probably not even detectable as a door on the prison side. It'd be disguised as a permacrete wall, maybe in a storage area.
The other end goes straight to a law enforcement station of some sort, and can only be opened from inside the station. If there's a prison riot or mass breakout and the prisoners take over, the authorities have a fast, secret way to get into the prison.
Jag considered.
So he sliced into the holocams observing the tunnel, and probably subverted them, and he may have already drilled an access into the tunnel itself. He'll be working on a bypass for the prison end door next.
That's it. He goes into the prison from this access, thaws Valen, brings him out the same way. Minimal fuss. But how does he find Valen?
Through the Force. Jaina says she can feel him, even in his present comatose state. More significantly, how did he find out about this tunnel?
I'm not sure. Back in the days of the Old Republic, Jedi sometimes helped the authorities in suppressing riots like this. Perhaps he found a reference to such an event in the Jedi archives.
I'll ask Jaina to look into that. Can you keep Seth's holocams from recording? If there's an access into that tunnel, we need to go down there.
I can.
Seth's access was easy to find. A sheet of Durasteel with weld marks all along its edges appeared to be a wall damage patch, but turned out to be simply held in place by four large blobs of a glue-like substance. Behind the metal sheet was a ragged circular hole, clearly cut by a lightsaber, into the tunnel shown on Seth's monitor. Jag and Winter entered the tunnel and walked its length, finding no sign of sabotage at the security station end. Seth had clearly been at work at the prison end, however. Sophisticated bypass gear had been attached to the access console beside the blast door. Winter activated it and ran through its memory, determining that it had been testing thousands of possible activation codes at a rate designed to prevent the security station's central computer from flagging the events as intrusion attempts.
It shouldn't take him much longer, she told Jag. A few hours, a day, maybe two.
In silent response, he pointed up. She looked that way and saw what he had found. Two small thermal detonators, one affixed to the ceiling above the blast door controls, one in the ceiling 20 meters down the tunnel.
He's bringing Valen out. Shuts the door if he can, and if there's a pursuit, he triggers the detonators, Jag explained, bringing the roof down and preventing further pursuit. There's another one, past the hole he cut. That will keep security station personnel from following.
Winter nodded.
So that's his plan. What's ours?
This tunnel is a perfect trap. We follow him in here, the two of us and Tahiri. We confront him, capture him, and spirit him back to the Jedi Temple.
Which is simple and brilliant as long as everything goes right. Now let's get out of here and start planning for everything that might go wrong.
Jag sighed.
I really thought that when I got out of flying for my living, I'd also get out of mission planning.
You aren't that lucky.
Chapter 21 Calrissian Nunba Mines, Kessel.
Seated around the table was a who's who of New Republic-era piloting history, and Leia was so cheered to see them all that she could not stop smiling. Wedge Antilles sat to Han's right. More relaxed now, since his retirement was proving to have some staying power, he had his feet up on the table before him, scuffed, ancient boots on the elegant stone top, much to Lando's unspoken dismay. Wedge sipped from a tumbler of Corellian brandy. Lean and graying, he still had the sharp, angular features and piercing gaze of his youth. He was dressed in the flight uniform of a New Republic X-Wing pilot, orange jumpsuit and mostly white accoutrements. But then, most of the pilots present had been dressed in the service uniforms appropriate to their starfighters when they arrived, and not all had had time to change into civilian clothes. Not all wanted to. Next to Wedge was Derek Hobby Clavian, still somber, some said mournful of appearance, on a brief break from his duties as a Coruscant spokesman for the Zaltin Corporation, the Bacta manufacturer. Beside Hobby sat Inuri Forge, a former Rogue Squadron pilot who had been born on Kessel. Her parents and surviving siblings were among those who had been evacuated from the planet as the ground shakes grew worse. They were temporarily quartered in old Imperial barracks on the Garrison Moon.
Brown-haired and fine-boned, she looked almost too delicate to be a pilot, but her kill record made a lie of that assumption. At the far end of the table was Kel Tanner, a large man about Leia's age. He was bald on top. He wore his long gray hair in a ponytail and had a drooping mustache. He looked far more like a pirate than a former member of the New Republic Starfighter Command, but his experience as a pilot, demolitions expert, and mechanic made him invaluable for the process of converting thermal detonators into warheads for other types of missile systems. Then there was Cheris Ki Hanedi, an Adumari pilot who was said to be deadlier with her vibroblade than with a starfighter. Short, dark-haired, and freckled, she looked like she should be managing a farm goods store. Next to Cheris was Nerin Vakil, a Quarren whose watertight flight suit sloshed because it was filled with salt water kept in constant circulation by a backpack processor. Beside him sat Rasati Ener, a human woman living on Coruscant. Her husband was Nawara Venn, currently Coruscant's best publicized advocate. She seemed a little uncomfortable sitting beside Merrick Steele, who was still brooding and vital despite the complete loss of his hair. He was an Imperial retiree who had served, among other roles, as an officer on Kessel's Garrison Moon, and later as a TIE fighter pilot in the famous 181st Imperial Fighter Group. And, Leia reflected, the pilots sitting with her and Tendra at the head of the table, Han, Lando, and Nia Nunba, weren't exactly slouches themselves. Lando wrapped a shot glass on the table to divert everyone from catching up talk and bring them back to the subject at hand.
"So we have a mixed bag of starfighters. X-wings, A-wings, a Blade 36, an 8 of 5 required under circumstances I won't discuss, and a TIE bomber whose owner wants it kept in the exquisite condition it now enjoys, so don't even think about scratching the paint. The next two crews of pilots I'll be briefing in here are the rescue vehicle crews and the subsonic crews. Those are the airspeeders you saw lined up outside. Each of you will be paired with one of them. Their job is to precede you into the cavern, activate the monstrous sonic systems we've mounted on their speeders, and drive out the animal life. Sometimes they'll be doing it at the same time as your missile pass, or after, if you're firing detonators on timer. If your detonator's supposed to go off on impact, they'll be preceding you.
Wedge took another sip of his drink.
Who's acting as mission control?
Tendra.
Tendra looked at her husband and shook her head. Lando continued smoothly.
Or someone else. I'll make sure it's someone with plenty of experience. Nobody's going to be forgotten.
Han stepped in.
The subsonics pilots are going to be doing more flying than the rest of us. They'll fly several passes in each cavern, driving the animal life in one direction. They'll be notifying mission control when each cavern is done.
Cheris raised a hand.
What if the bogeys knock down a subsonic speeder?
That's bound to happen, Leia confirmed. We have a whole net of sensors set up down there. If any vehicle goes down, it shows as being offline on our computer. We send in a rescue transport. Since the detonators are on mechanical timers, we can't abort. We're trying to make sure there's plenty of time between the end of a subsonics run and the scheduled detonation. Time to get any stranded pilots out. We're trying to preserve the lives of as many of the animals as we can, but the overriding goal is to save Kessel and keep our pilots alive.
Wedge offered Lando a slightly malicious smile.
100 to 1 says you weren't able to secure insurance for this little operation.
True. Lando looked regretful. I knew better. I didn't even try.
So if a starfighter goes down and gets blown up, you're paying for it out of pocket, correct?
Lando's expression went from regretful to mournful.
Dodging the bogeys is better for all of us. I can't stress that enough.
Tendra leaned forward.
Each of you will be responsible for hitting between 20 and 30 of the munitions devices. In most cases, you'll be targeting a spot near the device, and your warhead will not be set to explode on contact. It will go off on timer. Sometimes, though, it will be on impact. We'll try to remember to tell you which is which.
Considerate of you.
Also, if one of you goes down, Lando continued, that is, one of us goes down, as I'll be doing what you are in Lady Luck and Han in the Falcon, then the uncompleted targets on your list will be assigned to other pilots, the pilots with the nearest routes. Launch time is still holding at 0600 at local time tomorrow.
Though these veteran pilots were 20, 30, or 40 years older than green recruits, they groaned just like newly commissioned flyers. Lando offered them a bright smile.
Suffer! I have a toddler. I'll be up then anyway. We'll see you in the morning. And again, really, thanks.
No,
said Alana. Leia remained firm, at least on the outside. Looking down into Alana's anxious face, she didn't feel anywhere near as decisive.
It'll just be for a few hours. Chance is going to be there. He'll be with Nana.
Han, standing behind Leia's chair, gave his wife's shoulder a reassuring squeeze.
Leia and I can't keep you safe while we're firing off bombs in the caverns. You need to be on the garrison moon, especially if there are more groundquakes.
No!
Leia took a deep breath. Arguing with Alana was so much like arguing with Jason had been. The child was very bright, and she intellectualized, rationalized, like someone far beyond her 7 years. Sometimes the only thing Leia could use to win was pure willpower.
Alana, this isn't open for discussion. Han and I have decided.
The garrison moon is up in space. There's something waiting for me up in space.
Leia looked up at Han, but he seemed as baffled as she was. She turned back to Alana.
Something? What?
Something scary.
Alana?
Han's voice was not harsh, but there was a warning tone to it.
You shouldn't try to get out of things you don't want to do by fibbing.
Leia schooled herself to remain absolutely impassive. The number of times Han had gotten out of things he didn't want to do by lying, well, not to Leia, but to just about everyone else.
I'm not fibbing. There really is something up there. It talked to me.
Leia frowned.
When?
When I was outside the main building the other day, while you were underground.
What did it say?
It wanted to know who I was. It was sad, but scary.
Did anyone else hear this?
Alana shook her head. She lowered her voice to a whisper.
It talked through the Force.
Searching her grandparents' eyes, she continued, more desperately.
I know the difference between what's real and what's not. This was real.
Give us a minute.
Han gestured for Leia to accompany him outside Alana's temporary bedroom. Once they were in the hallway with the door shut, Han whispered,
What do you think?
She's telling the truth as she understands it, which means there may actually be something out there.
At a loss, Leia shrugged.
With the time we have available, we have 3 choices, none good. Leave her here in the main building, which means danger if the groundquakes get bad during our operation, which they very well may. Take her on the Falcon, where we'll be dealing with high explosives, potentially dangerous animal life, bogies, and perhaps collapsing caverns. Or send her to the garrison moon, where, if she's right, something may come after her.
Looking unhappy, Han considered.
If we have to choose one of those, I'd choose the one where we can watch after her ourselves.
Me too.
Han punched the door button. The door slid aside. Alana stood just inside, looking up at them, her face shining as though she'd heard the entire exchange.
I can go?
Han stooped to pick her up. He straightened without even a fake groan or a "you're getting too heavy" comment.
You can, he told her. If you promise to be a good member of the crew. That means following orders, even the ones you hate.
I promise.
All right.
And we fib all the time. Every time you call me Amelia, that's a fib, isn't it?
Han scowled at her.
Don't confuse the issues with facts. Leia does that all the time, and I hate it.
Armand Isard, Correctional Facility, Coruscant. Seff Helen stepped through the hole he'd burned in the permacrete mere days before and pulled the metal sheet into place again. With luck, this was the last time he'd have to do that, the last time ever. He was so close to his goal that he could feel himself trembling. The isolation he'd felt for so long might at last come to an end. He still wasn't sure how he'd recognized Valen over the holo recordings of the man's trial, how he'd instantly realized that it was the true Valen, not some imposter. But he had. Soon he would free his fellow surviving Jedi Knight, and maybe, just maybe,
Valen would have answers that Seth lacked. The tunnel was as he'd left it, the near end still rigged with his bypass equipment. Something was different, though, which he could recognize even at the distance of 20 meters. The main light indicator on the console now glowed green instead of red. It had completed its task. It had cracked the door's access code. He breathed a sigh of relief and headed that way. Something else was different, too, and he was in mid-stride, halfway between his entrance and the door, when he felt it. This was a faint stirring in the force, more subtle than most he had felt in recent times. There were presences nearby. They weren't workers in adjacent tunnels or prison personnel beyond the door. He could feel that they were waiting for him. He stopped and slowly turned, unsealing the front of his workman's jumpsuit, and pulled his lightsaber from beneath its folds. The metal patch he'd set over his access hole was gone, pulled away so quietly that he hadn't heard it. From this angle, Seth could not see much through the gap, but the intruder wasn't waiting. She stepped through into his view. He knew her all right. Tahiri Vela, or actually the imposter in her form. She was not dressed as a Jedi. She wore a tight-fitting jumpsuit all in black, almost featureless. Nor was she barefoot. Her lightsaber, unlit, was in her hand. Her expression was grave. He gave her a look of scorn.
You could do better than that. At least get the footwear or lack of it right.
Her answer was almost a whisper.
Just like Valen.
She moved sideways, all feline grace, until she was in the center of the tunnel.
Which is why I have to be stopped, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell your comrades to come on in. I want to see who they're impersonating.
The false Tahiri glanced toward the hole and nodded. A man stepped through, but Seth did not recognize him. Though not tall, the man was burly, clad in loose-fitting pants and tunic in black, with dull silver gloves protruding from the cuffs of his garment. He wore a black hood that cast his face into shadow. He looked unarmed, though he could have been hiding a multitude of weapons under the tunic. On second glance, his burliness was not natural. Seth was sure the man wore some sort of breastplate under the cloth. Coming through the gap in the wall, he had not bent properly at the waist. He was stiff in his movements. That sent a jolt of alarm down Seth's spine.
A Mando. Of course they'd send a Mando against me.
The hooded man said nothing, and whoever else was beyond the gap did not enter, did not come within sight. With at least 3-1 odds, speed and aggression were of the essence. Not waiting for any irrelevant declaration of intent or repartee from his opponents, Seth threw up a hand, exerting his will through the Force. The false Tahiri merely narrowed her eyes as she used her own powers to adhere to the permacrete beneath her. But the unknown Mando staggered backward and slid for many meters, flailing. Perhaps he wasn't a Mandalorian after all. He seemed too awkward. The false Tahiri waited only a moment until Seth's surge flagged, and then ignited her lightsaber and charged forward. Seth lit his own blade.
Seth, things will be a lot better if you just surrender.
She twitched her blade, a feint designed to lure him into a premature attack. Seth pretended to fall for it, striking down at her, a classic cleaving blow. But he jerked the blow to a halt and redirected it down at an angle against her left side. Halfway into a block against the anticipated blow, Tahiri had to leap frantically back and maneuver her blade into the path of Seth's, a successful block that nevertheless left her off balance and on the retreat.
You're lucky, Seth told her.
He struck again, throwing a series of attacks to keep her off balance.
Whoever you are, I have far less contempt for you than for the real Tahiri. Murderous traitor, pathetic slave to her emotions. That's what she is.
Seth was surprised to feel a jolt of anger and hurt from his opponent. Could it be that she identified so strongly with the woman whose face she wore? Interesting. He kept up his attack. He felt the Mando re-enter the fight before there was any visual evidence of it. The black-clad man was on one elbow, as if hurt and struggling to rise. And then Seth saw that the man had drawn a blaster pistol, built oversized to accommodate his crush gauntlets, but had concealed the action behind the sleeve of his other arm. The Mando swept his obscuring arm out of the way and fired, a blue stun bolt headed toward Seth. Seth felt a jolt of jubilation. He caught the bolt on his blade and deflected it down into the false Tahiri's leg. Tahiri's eyes widened for a fraction of a second, then rolled up into her head, she fell backward. Now, to take advantage of the situation before his enemies could regroup, Seth dashed back to the blast door into the prison and hit two buttons, one to open the door, one to trigger the thermal detonator toward the center of the corridor. Nothing happened. He wasn't too surprised. If his enemies had found his work here, they could easily have sabotaged his computer. He glanced back. The Mando was on his feet, headed Seth's way, pistol in hand. Seth glanced up to where he'd planted the nearest thermal detonator. With an exertion of telekinesis, he yanked it free and let it drop to the floor of the tunnel. It made a metallic sound as it hit. He made sure he could visualize the triggering button. Then he sent the small, canister-shaped weapon rolling toward the fallen Tahiri. The Mando skidded to a stop beside Tahiri. Stooping, he picked up the unconscious woman, then turned and ran, sheltering her with his body. Grinning, Seth kept the detonator rolling after them, even allowing it to bounce once or twice for additional noise. But he let the Mando gain on his rolling weapon. His task was not to kill these enemies. When the detonator was halfway down the tunnel, when the Mando and the unconscious woman were far enough ahead that the blast might not kill them, Seth dropped into a crouch, turned away from the detonator, clamped his hands over his ears, and telekinetically pressed the trigger. There was a brief pause. Then the world flashed red and white. Walls and floor shook, and Seth's ears were hammered as though he'd been cuffed by a rancor. Braced as he was, the shockwave of the explosion still slammed him into the blast door. He was pelted with superheated pieces of permacrete gravel, one of which burned his side and caught his jumpsuit on fire. The lights went out and smoke filled the air. Shaky, he rose, patting out the burning portion of his garment. He was now in complete darkness. Complete, until he reignited his lightsaber. The gleam from his blade showed the tunnel collapsed, rubble filling it to within 10 meters of where he stood. His bypass computer was wreckage. The blast door was unhurt, at least for the moment. If he'd calculated correctly, there would now be a crater in the bare kill zone above. The prison personnel would be on alert, but guessing either that there had been some sort of fuel mishap outside the prison, or at worst, that someone was trying to stage a prison break from without, his entry was likely to remain a secret, for now. And his enemies, if still alive, were trapped on the other side of the rubble. He got to work, pressing the tip of his blade against the metal of the blast doors just at the seam, watching the Durasteel begin to glow red, then orange, then luminous yellow.
Chapter 22.
Jag yanked his hood and helmet free. He gasped for air. The explosion had hit him like a metal beam in the chest, driving the air from his lungs. He knew it would have been much worse if he had not been wearing his Mandalorian breastplate. Rising to his knees, he drew out a glow rod. The blue light it cast showered Tahiri, flat on her face beside him, and a tremendous mound of construction wreckage behind them. His blaster pistol was nowhere to be seen. He pulled off his left crush gaunt and pressed fingers against Tahiri's neck. He could feel her pulse and saw her lips part in a groan he barely heard. He became aware that there was a faint noise emerging from his helmet. He raised it to his ear.
Gaunt, Sand, this is Hoth. Come in.
The voice was mechanically distorted and deepened, not clearly recognizable as either human or female, but it was definitely Winter, using the call signs they'd agreed upon for him and Tahiri.
Gaunt, Sand, come in.
Even through the distortion, there was an edge of worry to the voice.
Hoth, this is Gaunt.
Talking hurt, Jag paused to draw in a pained breath.
Sand is down, but recovering. Madneck is separated from us, continuing his mission. Are you intact?
Gaunt, Hoth, not badly hurt.
Jag looked at the debris mound. He switched his glow rod over to a focused beam, shining it across the top of the mound. There were gaps there. It was a precarious, dangerous thing, but there might be a way across.
Call in the rest of Darkmeld. Bring in whoever you can. Bring them in close and have them stand by. If we're lucky, this won't be a complete foul-up.
Understood.
Gaunt out.
Hoth out.
Tahiri's eyes opened. There was no confusion in them, only anger. She experimentally moved her head, then rolled over onto her back.
Did he have to hit me with a whole cargo ship?
Her voice was almost distinct. Jag's hearing was returning. Jag pulled his crush gaunt back on.
Turns out that just because he's crazy, he's not inept. Who would have guessed?
He donned his helmet again. She rose.
Where's my lightsaber?
He stood as well, looking over the mound.
Somewhere under that, I suspect.
Her expression turned sour.
This just keeps getting better and better.
Seth peered around another sub-level corner, spotted the security holocam down the corridor, and caused it to fuzz for a moment as he ran past. He'd had no pursuit, nor was there any sign that the prison's internal security forces were alert to him. And now he could feel Valen, a dull, faint light in the force, very close, one or two levels up, not more than 40 meters laterally from his position. It took a simple bypass to get this level's turbolift doors open. The prison designers had done him a disservice by making the air shafts far too small for an adult human to crawl through. But air shafts were not the only accesses. Now he started up the turbolift shaft. The lift car itself was far above him, not moving. Seth suspected that the state of alert caused by the explosion had resulted in all the turbolifts going to a certain level and locking down. So much the better for him. He leapt across to the ladder rungs on the back of the shaft and began climbing. The door two levels up would have been even easier to bypass. He was operating from the undefended shaft interior instead of the exterior, except that he had to do the delicate electronics work with one hand while hanging by the other from the top of the access box. But finally, it offered up a little spark of defeat, and the door slid open. Three security guards, armed and armored for a riot, stood on the other side. They'd had their backs to the lift door, but turned in surprise as the door slid up. Seth jumped to stand in their midst.
Sorry, he told them,
then kneed the one on the left viciously in the stomach, while putting an elbow into the temple of the one on the right, cracking the man's helmet. The one in the center backed away, bringing his blaster rifle into line, and got a shot off. Seth sensed his intent, a chest shot, and twisted out of the way. The blast passed close enough behind him to sear his shoulder blades. He ignited his lightsaber and cut the blaster rifle in half at the base of the barrel. The guard, wide-eyed, continued his backpedaling and reached for his comlink, but Seth kicked him square in the jaw. The guard fell, unconscious, his jaw disturbingly askew. Seth took a look around. This level of the prison, still below the surface, was dimly lit and quiet. The high-ceilinged main corridor and its all-metal walls led right and left from the turbolift lobby. It had many doors, some of them oversized, all of them closed. He nodded. This would be a storage level, and it was reasonable for them to put the harmless Valen Horn here. There was a holocam mounted at the ceiling corner. It was pointed straight at him, straight at the spot where people entered or left the turbolift. If it was being monitored at this moment, he would be discovered. He fuzzed it, hoping that he had not yet been detected, and left it that way for the seconds it took him to shut the turbolift door and then pull the three unconscious